Good morning again. The court calls United States v. Carter. I'll state for the record, as I did for the previous case, that Judge Ryan will be participating on the briefs. Thank you. Counsel for the appellant.
Judge Ryan.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, I'm Captain Patrick Crocker, and Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter, and I represent Private First Class Colin Carter. There are three main points to help this court resolve the issue presented today in this case. First, a government violation of Article 13 by engaging in illegal pretrial punishment is wholly different from the government's use of legal non-judicial punishment under Article 15. Two, the role of the military judge in determining whether an Article 13 violation has occurred and then awarding credit is similarly wholly different than the sentencing authority in determining an appropriate sentence. And three, the Gammons framework, which is based on the language in Article 15F and as written in Gammons, is intended to rein in the very broad language of Pierce, should not be analogized to Article 13 issues to keep defense counsel from both asking for Article 13 credit in a motion and then presenting the facts of the government conduct as mitigation in sentencing. The military judge in this case relied on Southwick and the Gammons framework to do exactly that. And that was error that materially prejudiced Private Carter because he was not able to present the panel with mitigation evidence that may have substantially swayed them under Reyes.
But what Southwick was a pretrial punishment issue. And didn't the language in Southwick indicate or actually say that it's an election between two available alternatives?
It did, yes, Your Honor.
That seems pretty clear.
It is clear, and at the time, Southwick was dealing with the rule from Huffman regarding affirmative waiver in Article 13, and it was attempting to work with that because that was a very rigid rule as it was written in Huffman. So Southwick created a tantamount to affirmative waiver rule, and in doing that, it cited Gammons and Edwards, but it cited it as CF, so it was saying this is a sufficiently analogous case. So in Enom, the court overruled that and went with the new 2002 version 905 saying razor wave and got rid of tantamount's affirmative waiver. When you get rid of a rule, you also get rid of the underlying reasoning supporting the rule, because the only reason to look at Gammons was to say that this was a tactical decision that was tantamount to affirmative waiver. When you don't have a need for that rule anymore, you don't have a need to reference back to other case law, and the case law, especially this in the Article 15 vein.
So you think the language in Southwick is gone? The language in Southwick?
Yes, Your Honor. The language regarding referencing back to Gammons, referencing to the Article 15 lineage of cases to support the tantamount to affirmative waiver rule, that is gone because they now said the whole rule.
The waiver rule may well be gone, but I'm talking about when they talk about the election between two available alternatives.
Yes, Your Honor. That was the reasoning to support the tantamount to affirmative waiver rule. And when you get rid of the rule, you get rid of the reasoning as well. There's no need for it anymore. Now it's razor wave. And so there's no need to reference over to Article 15. And Article 15 has a very different history and a very different lineage, a very different purpose. There, Article 15F and the language in Article 15F is what Gammons was writing about and what Pierce was writing about. And Pierce had that very broad language that said the government can't use non-judicial punishment or evidence of it for any reason. And the Gammons court said that is dangerous because it can turn what's supposed to be a shield in Article 15F into a sword because the dicta is so broad. So Gammons was attempting to rein in Pierce, and it established a list, you know, four different ways that the defense could go at it. But that list isn't expressly mutually exclusive. It's listed in one part in Section, I believe, 4A of Gammons. It's listed in one part talking about waiver, essentially saying this is how to determine if the issue has been waived or not. They can do these things. And then later it talks about it with regard to an appellate authority reviewing the case to make sure that essentially a complete credit had been given. So, this is how the appellate courts can view the issue.
If we buy your argument and you get two bites at the apple, does the judge have to instruct the members that credit was given for illegal pretrial treatment or confinement or whatever? Do the members need to know that?
Your Honor, I think they do. I think in fairness, the members need to be notified of that. I think telling the members exactly how many days invites credit nullification from the panel, as we had in Barton.
Well, no. That's exactly what I'm asking.
Okay.
The judge instructs the members basically something along the line of the accused has asked for credit because of alleged blah, 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 blah. I instruct you that I have given 13 days of administrative credit for that purpose.
Yes, Your Honor. That is the way that a lot of judges have handled it. They've analogized it to pretrial confinement credit, and our position is that the panel should be notified that credit has been given, but giving them an exact number is going to just invite credit nullification and make a complex situation.
Well, no, it's going to invite they're the sentencing authority.
Yes, sir.
It's going to invite total murkiness if they don't. You know, ha ha ha, I gave them credit, but you can't know.
Yes, Your Honor. And what you said earlier about two bites of the apple, that's one of the main points of the argument I'm trying to make today, and one of the main things for this court to consider is it's not really two bites at the same apple. It's a bite at an apple and a bite at an orange.
It's credit and credit.
Your Honor, the panel is not being asked to give credit for Article 13. They're not. In fact, Article 13 and whether there's been a violation of it.
Right. And which way does that cut? That's a judicial function, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Okay. Then why should they be allowed to argue it at all to the members?
Because, Your Honor, it goes to mitigation, and specifically...
Well, of course it goes to mitigation, but you've already been mitigated.
It goes to specifically informing the sentencing authority of all the facts and circumstances surrounding an accused.
But you don't want to inform the sentencing authority of all the facts and circumstances. You don't want them to know how much credit he's already gotten.
Yes, Your Honor, and the way that the judges have been doing it has been to tell them exactly how much credit.
Okay.
And so that's...
And that's something you'd buy.
That's something that I think is acceptable. I think that it could potentially create the situation that we had in Barnett, but that's an acceptable risk, and that's something that defense counsel, in consultation with the accused, should be able to make a decision about whether we want to go at it that way or not. Because if the judge only awards nominal credit, then maybe there's low risk. If there is credit nullification, if they get awarded a lot of credit, maybe they decide not to present it at all.
And does it follow that if the military judge should instruct or can instruct on this issue, the trial counsel can argue the issue?
Yes, Your Honor. And specifically in this case, and this is not a unique case with regard to how this may be presented, but in this case, one of the soldiers that imposed some of this pretrial punishment was Sergeant First Class Magdalena. He was called as a sentencing witness by the government to say that Private Carter had low rehabilitation potential. But the defense was not able to stand up and say, well, one of the reasons Sergeant First Class Magdalena may have a negative view of this guy is because Private Carter was being subjected to all of this harsh treatment. And it may be understandable that somebody wouldn't respond well to that, or that Sergeant First Class Magdalena had a preconceived idea that this guy was guilty, and that's why he was doing this pretrial punishment, and that's also why he has this opinion. But they weren't allowed to present any of that evidence, and that's certainly relevant for the sentencing authority to know, especially with regard to where the witnesses are coming from that the government presents.
Now, doesn't the defense essentially have to argue, if there was Article 13 credit given, and they make their argument to the jury or to the members on sentencing, that you've had the judge tell you that he has already given credit for Article 13 violation, whether or not you've given an actual number of days or just generally. If they're going to ask for more, aren't they actually saying that the military judge screwed up? He didn't give enough credit, and I want more credit, and you guys can set this right.
Your Honor, it's not an issue of credit. They're not going to the panel, asking the panel to make a determination about whether legally an Article 13 violation occurred and then asking for...
Well, I realize that. You're not talking about credit in Article 13 strict sense. What you're asking for is a decrease in the sentence that they would have given him absent that treatment.
What they're asking for, Your Honor, is for the panel to give a fair sentence based on all the facts and circumstances. And the government's conduct, especially illegal pretrial conduct, or any conduct, even if it's determined not to be an Article 13 violation, is relevant. It's The Article 13 issue, Article 13 and a violation of it and credit given is like one tree. And the panel is considering the entire forest. It's just one small aspect.
Getting back to your initial position that the military judge should tell them that he has awarded credit but not give them a specific number of days, doesn't that cut both ways? If the military judge says, I've already given credit for Article 13 violations, and then moves on, then the members may think, well, I took care of that.
They may, and they may disregard any of the testimony or evidence that comes in, or even the evidence that comes in via unsworn, or information that comes in via unsworn. It could cut both ways. These are all things for the defense counsel to consider when figuring out how to present this. And there are too many variables in Article 13 type scenarios. There's too many, there's such a huge range of things that the government may or may not do. And every case is unique. And so it should be left to defense counsel to figure out how to present that. And then if there are concerns, an instruction can be given that will eliminate the possibility of double credit, even though it's not really a double credit. One is a credit given for a violation, and the other is just the panel considering it as a fact among many facts.
But you're trying to argue sentence mitigation, is it, right?
Yes, sir.
The first is for credit, or credit is probably the wrong word, an award for the government's conduct.
Yes, sir.
And then you want to turn around and say to the panel, hasn't he been punished enough, notwithstanding the fact that the judge, as a matter of law, has awarded him proper credit for what occurred. Is that correct?
Your Honor, it depends.
It's about sentence mitigation. You're not arguing, now we'd like to get credit again, because that's not what you're doing. If you're arguing on sentencing, you're arguing mitigation, probably not aggravation.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, it would not be an aggravation argument. It's saying, here are all of the facts and circumstances relating to the accused, his crime, his dog died when he was seven, his mother loves him.
It's almost a clemency argument. All these terrible things, please give me less than you might have otherwise.
Please give me a sentence that matches all the facts and circumstances surrounding.
Okay, so that's the benign way that it could be presented. But what happens if we have a case where defense counsel says 27 days credit? We want you, specifically says to the panel, we want you to provide him with 30 days more credit or 27 more days credit. So it's not the benign approach that you're painting, but something different. How should the military judge handle that?
That would be improper. That would be an improper application of, or improper use.
So how would this court, in an opinion, spell out to military judges with some specificity, this is what you can permit the defense counsel to do in this case, and this is what you should rein in?
I think two things. One, saying defense counsel should be allowed to get up and ask for a specific number of days, because that's not the role of the sentencing authority. And that has already been addressed. And it would probably be improper even if the Article 13 motion hadn't been made to begin with, because the sentencing authority would have to then make some kind of determination of law about whether a violation of Article 13 occurred or didn't occur. But the two things have nothing to do with each other. If Article 13 went away, if Congress tomorrow struck Article 13 completely, the defense counsel would still be able to make these arguments as mitigation and still talk about what the government did. So I said the first is that they shouldn't be allowed to ask for a specific number of days or couch the issue as credit in any way, because that's the role of the judge. Two, I think that they should be limited to basically the facts of the government conduct, and the focus should really be on the effect on the accused, because that is really what the mitigation evidence is supposed to be about, is the effect that different things have on
them. So the effect on the accused rather than the bad acts of the government.
It's hard to untangle those a lot of the time. And specifically in an instance where, let's say that there's a whole litany of facts, the judge finds that some of those facts are violations of Article 13 and others aren't. That's what makes the government's position untenable here. It looks like a clear black letter rule, but it doesn't function that way, because you would run into a situation where certain facts would then come in and other facts would be left out, and there would be holes left, and it would be it's a little bit of hide the ball from the sentencing authority. The sentencing authority needs to be aware of all of these things. And 403 is the gateway. 403 is really the gateway, and the military judge has the ability to say these things are, through 401, 402, relevant or not relevant, and 403 saying these things are probative or prejudicial, weighing that in making a determination.
And the trial counsel can respond as well.
Yes, Your Honor.
So
yes,
if the accused goes this way, or the, whatever he is now, he opens the door to whatever, to the government's own rebuttal, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The government would be able to respond to those things. But it's really, it should not be couched when it's discussed as mitigation. The issue shouldn't be couched as Article 13. In fact, Article 13 does not even need to be said. It's just the government's conduct. Here's what the government did, and here's the effect it had on the accused. And that is a broader, separate issue from the very narrow issue of Article 13, that violation, and then sort of an amorphous credit calculation that flows from that.
But you would agree that even though the scope of conduct in mitigation is broader, no doubt, than the Article 13, the Article 13 credits have addressed at least some of that conduct.
Yes, Your Honor, they would have addressed some of that conduct.
And then, see, this is where I'm having trouble trying to figure out how you're going to craft an instruction to give the proper weight to that without getting into a very detailed, you know, this was an Article 15 or an Article 13 violation, and list them, and then say this is what he was awarded for that, and now you can go ahead and all of these other things weren't included. I mean, and that seems to be kind of counterproductive or at least time-consuming.
Well, I don't think it would be proper to ask the panel to suss out the differences between the things that are specifically Article 13 credit or specifically not. I think just telling the panel some of the conduct that the government has engaged in has been deemed to be a violation of Article 13, and he has received either credit for that or a certain number of days of credit for that. The what makes this different from pretrial confinement credit, Allen Mason credit, or Pierce credit, is that this is not, Article 13 credit is not a complete credit, as it's been called. It's been what I think the best term to talk about it in is infected credit. And that's Suzuki, which comes from Larner, the language in Larner. So the credit has to be effective to remedy the issue. And military judges give Article 13 credit as a compensatory measure sometimes, which is the other types of credit are all purely compensatory or remunerative. But Article 13 credit is also given as a stick to the government sometimes to send a message to them that they don't need to be engaging in this type of conduct. It's punitive in that regard. And so the type of credit given or the credit given is of a different ilk.
But the panel does the same thing sometimes. They listen to all this stuff and they say, okay, government, we're going to show you, you know, this, we're not going to give this guy any confinement time.
They do. They may do that.
So the same interests are involved.
Yes, Your Honor. And it's just the purpose and function of the credit is different in Article 13. And
your time is up.
Yes, sir.
Did you want to finish your sentence, as long as it's a short sentence?
Your Honor, I'll finish my sentence on rebuttal.
I really didn't mean to interrupt you in the middle of a sentence, but it seemed like you should be tipped off that your clock had run.
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize.
You have time on rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Jeehan Walker, and along with Major Trev Corey, we represent the government in this matter. This court should affirm the finding and sentence for three reasons. First, as gatekeeper, appellant exercised a tactical decision by agreeing to 25 days credit for the asserted Article 13 violations. Second, appellant failed to demonstrate the relevancy of this evidence under rules for court-martial 1001 Charlie and military rules of evidence 403. And third, appellant has not shown prejudice in this case. The military judge properly relied upon Southwick and Gammons in her ruling. Southwick expressed and established the gatekeeper rule, and that is still good law. Inon overruled the tantamount to affirmative waiver requirement. That was a consequence of the tactical decision But that was not an overruling of the gatekeeper rule itself. And Imam was very specific in saying that Southwick was only overruled to the extent that it expressed a tantamount to an affirmative waiver. The point being that the gatekeeper rule is still good law, and it basically establishes that an appellant or an accused can choose between two available alternatives: presenting evidence to a military judge through a motion for Article 13 credit, or presenting the evidence during the pre-sentencing portion of the trial. And there's evidence for this court to rely on that lower courts are still relying on Southwick. In my supplemental citation to authority, I cited a Navy Court of Appeals case in which they relied upon Southwick and on intensely in determining that a defense counsel's tactics in presenting Article 13 evidence during the pre-sentencing phase of trial instead of moving for credit from the government was an effective tactic.
Does Article 13 present a legal question?
Article 13, yes, Your Honor, presents questions of law for the military judge to decide. First, whether or not there was pretrial punishments and an intent to punish, that part is actually a question of fact. But then whether also if the conditions of the confinement were unduly rigorous. The application of that credit, this court has reaffirmed in multiple cases, is a question of law that was reaffirmed in
the case. Is it the government's view, putting aside whether there was error in this case based on the case law at the time, is it the government's view that then, or I think it is the government's view, that the defense counsel should then choose whether they have the question of law and the award for Article 13 violations presented to members versus the judge?
Yes, so the
defense counsel gets to say, I want this question of law to be resolved by the members rather than the judge.
So if I understand
that's
question,
essentially what you're asking us to conclude.
Are you asking that members decide this question of law, Your Honor?
It appears that would be the thing. If you're making the defense counsel say, you have to choose to bring your Article 13 concerns to either to the military judge or to members, but you can't do both.
That is not the government's position.
Okay, what's the government's position then?
The position is that when the military judge addresses Article 13, it's focused on government action answering questions of law. For the defense to be able to present this evidence to panel members, they have to show relevancy beyond that government action. It's possible for them to do that, but the focus would not be on the government action at that point.
So you're saying in theory, although not in this case, you have no problem with the general proposition that the military judge awards Article 13 credit or doesn't, and the members do sentence mitigation or they don't. But you are now saying, but in all likelihood, as in this case, in your view, it wouldn't be relevant as sentence mitigation and it may not pass 403 as sentence mitigation.
In theory, yes, Your Honor.
So I'm just testing. I don't see you pushing hard on the proposition that you can't do Article 13 in sentence mitigation, but you have to argue sentence mitigation based on relevance in 403.
Well, the gatekeeper rule is really a recognition that the probative value of this evidence is low because it focuses on government action. And once it's already been litigated, that low probative value is substantially outweighed by wasting fact finders' time, presenting needlessly cumulative.
I understand that it's shifting the debate, though, to the 401, 403 debate.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, yeah. So now the government has gone from what I thought the government was saying, because you used the word gatekeeper, which to me implies an election. It may not imply waiver, but we don't have to go there. And now the government's position is substantially more wishy-washy, which is that you can give it to the judge, and the judge will do whatever he does in the exercise of his judicial functions. And then, given relevance, how could it not be relevant to sentencing?
Well, looking at rules for court-martial 1001, Charlie.
Yeah, 1001 is pretty broad.
When you look at the paragraph, Your Honor, it lays out for mitigation the definition, lessening the punishment, or furnishing a grounds for clemency. But the immediately following sentence lays specific examples of what that would be, such as particular good acts of conduct or bravery. Those relate to an accused. Reputation or record of the accused, again, relating to an individual.
Why is it not relevant to sentencing that the government subjected the accused to unduly harsh conditions?
Well, Looking at the potential.
Oh, why is it not relevant to mitigation?
Right, Your Honor. Looking at the explanations, the examples that are listed in Rules for Court Martial 1001 Charlie, it has to relate to characteristics or traits of the accused. And the conditions in and of themselves.
Oh, well, then you're saying the same thing in a different way. If it's governmental action, by definition, it doesn't relate to traits of the accused.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, then it's never available unless he elects to do it at the back end rather than the front end? Or are you saying that he can never use it as mitigation because it doesn't relate to anything in 1001?
I think a savvy defense counsel could potentially try to demonstrate the relevancy by saying he went through these conditions, has learned his lesson from it, and is remorseful. The focus would be on the remorse of that soldier, not the conditions themselves. The conditions would highlight it.
I suppose if I were subjected to substantially harsh conditions, I'd be remorseful. I'd also be mad. But I just don't get where the government is going here. Because first you seem to have an exception that swallowed the rule, and now you seem to have a rule that swallows the exception. And I just don't know where the government's going here.
Can I ask this? The way I understood it, your initial argument coming in here was that it was an either-or, that if they brought this up on an Article 13 motion, then they could not use it in mitigation. It was one or the other. But now it seems to me you're saying that if they bring it up in an Article 13 motion they can still bring it up in mitigation as long as the military judge makes a determination that it's relevant, that it's proper under 1001, and do a 403 balancing test. That's much different than saying it's either or. So where are you? Are we at either or are we at, it's a determination that the military judge makes on a case-by-case basis?
It's the either or option, Your Honor, but with the recognition that the gatekeeper role is not per se, that there are some circumstances in which an accused could potentially show beyond the government action that even though they're relitigating the same issues, going into the same evidence, that probative value potentially is not substantially outweighed in that circumstance.
So you're not looking for a rule that says it's absolutely either or?
No, Your Honor. I'm looking for a rule that affirms Southwick as it initially stood and incorporates Rule for Court Martial 1001 Charlie and Military Rules of Evidence 403.
Could I ask a question then?
Yes, Your Honor.
How does your position this morning differ materially from the position the appellant's counsel is taking this morning?
Materially, it establishes parameters in which a military judge could make the determination in admitting that evidence. As I understand the defense position, the Article 13 evidence is always admissible, and the military judge does a 401, 403 analysis balancing test. And this particular, the gatekeeper rule recognizes that if the accused does not present the evidence at all to the military judge, understanding then that government action has a low probative value, but in that circumstance, it's not substantially outweighed by anything because it hasn't been previously litigated. It's taking into recognition that if the accused moves for credit from that military judge, effectively, the defense is going to have a higher burden of meeting that relevance and 403 balancing test. So it doesn't operate as a per se rule, but in many circumstances, it's going to be harder for the defense to get around that and present the evidence once it's previously been litigated.
Now you've got me again.
So it appears that in response to Judge Olson's question, neither party is arguing for an absolute rule. And the appellant can correct me on rebuttal. You have the opportunity to do so right away. You are not arguing for an absolute rule of you either get to do an Article 13 motion or you get to argue sentence mitigation to the members. And the appellant is not arguing that you, in all cases, get to do an Article 13 motion and present sentence mitigation to the members. You then are going to both fight out relevance and 403. And my sense is your line on 401 and 403 will be different than the appellant's, but that's going to be a contextual judgment made in the context of a particular case with particular arguments, not based on an absolute rule that says you can always do it or you can never do it.
That's correct, Your Honor. If this court were to adopt a per se rule, there would still be protection for the accused if they were to go that far. It's just that there's precedent when you look at Southwick and Tansley. This court recognized that there is an effective tactic in presenting the evidence to the members. And in Southwick, I believe the panel members, 5 to 7 of the panel members, furnished recommendations, clemency recommendations in that case. So it's difficult to say that in all circumstances that Article 13 evidence would never be relevant, particularly in that case.
Well, if that's the case,
not previously litigated.
What kind of an instruction should the military judge give then to the members when this is brought up in mitigation and the military judge has already awarded credit for at least some of the underlying conduct? I mean, how does this become workable?
It would have to be tailored instructions, Your Honor.
Well, I know. How do you tailor that? I mean, I'm just wondering. It's a difficult area to tailor something that is either not going to be overly beneficial or, you know, doesn't accurately reflect the scope of credit that was already given. That, to me, just seems like a very difficult area. But it does seem to me, and I think that my sense is that the two parties don't disagree on the process at this point. They disagree on how that process is applied in this case.
And if your approach is the correct approach, didn't the military judge in the instant case get it wrong?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the military judge offered the defense twice to demonstrate the relevancy of this evidence. The first time was at Joint Appendix 8 through 9, and the defense only said, we want to go into the conditions that the accused.
But didn't the military judge said, you have to pick? Yeah, I may have it wrong, but that, I thought the military judge said you had to pick. I think if the military judge said, you can choose, but you don't have to choose, but I find that in this case your evidence isn't relevant, that would be one thing. But I think the judge in this case said, well, that's not even relevant to argue relevance because you got to pick.
Well, she allowed the defense counsel again to say what the relevancy of the evidence was, and the defense counsel again turned to Article 13 evidence, restriction tantamount to confinement, pretrial conditions. She didn't do anything to demonstrate that this evidence was anything other than government action. She didn't show any relevancy beyond that. And so then when the military judge looked at Southwick and Gammons and decided you don't get two bites of the same apple, that was effectively saying this is a waste of time, it's cumulative evidence, it's already been resolved.
Well, if the...
In any event, whether the military judge erred or not, the government's view today is that no absolute rule, argue it out on relevance and 403.
No, Your Honor. It would be understanding that in most circumstances, once it's already been litigated, it's not going to meet those requirements.
But that's an argue it out on relevance in 403, understanding that the government starts over here and most accused will start over here.
Well, are you saying that under 1001, it's not going to come in because it doesn't deal with the individualized qualities of the accused?
Yes, sir. I'm saying that the is
the government giving this with one hand and pulling it back with the other hand, saying it's really practically a nullity because it doesn't come with it? Most of this stuff deals with conditions of confinement, and it doesn't come within 1001.
Most of the time, yes, sir, it will not be relevant, especially when this court has emphasized in U.S. v. Zarbantani that when there's an Article 13 violation, meaningful relief must be granted, and that takes into consideration the nature of the violations and the harm that's suffered.
Well, then why are we wasting our time talking about mitigation? They either do it with the judge or they don't do it and they waive it.
This court has the discretion to adopt that rule. Yes, sir.
Counsel, it seems to me we've got two different issues before this court. One is how we decide the instant case.
Yes, sir.
And secondly is how do we provide guidance to the field about how to proceed. In regard to the first one, just getting back to the point I made and the chief judge made, here the military judge said, I believe that the defense counsel already chose how to present the evidence, and so it would be inappropriate to allow them to have a second bite at the apple and get credit. So wasn't he, based on what you are arguing this morning, didn't he get the law wrong and therefore wasn't under abuse of discretion?
No, Your Honor, because she specifically relied on Southwick, and that's the proposition Southwick lays out, is that an accused chooses between making
She didn't get the law wrong at the time, which shifts to Judge Olson's second question, which is what should the law be going forward?
This court should continue to adhere to U.S. v. Southwick.
Which is different than what we've been talking about for a while. Absolute rule prohibiting the same information coming in as sentencing mitigation is Southwick, for whether it is or isn't, let's pretend it is.
Yes, sir.
Versus you can argue it in sentence mitigation as well, understanding that you still have to get over the relevance and 403 hurdles. And having already presented it on Article 13, you may even lose some relevance value there, but you're not ruling out the possibility that an appellant or an accused can make the relevance in 403 argument.
Yes, sir.
Do you see the two choices?
Yes, sir, I do.
Going forward, it's not a trick to trap you into saying in this case there was error. There may or may not have been error, but the government's view is there couldn't have been error based on Southwick.
Yes, sir. Going forward.
This is about getting the law right for everyone and not just deciding this case, right?
Right, sir. Taking Southwick for the proposition that there's a per se one you have to choose between those elections. That would cleanly avoid dealing with issues of conferring double credit or negating the credit that has already been decided. It would cleanly avoid situations in which this evidence could potentially come in and waste the fact finder's time and present needlessly cumulative evidence.
But that's a 403 argument.
It does incorporate 403, yes, sir.
So the government's prepared to turn over Article 13 determinations to members, a question of law.
No, sir. Under United States v. Spostat, that is still a question of law.
But your problem is, if you say you got to pick, the defense counsel says, okay, we're going to pick members. Thank you. You said I had to pick one. I can't do Article 13 with the judge. You said I had to pick members or judge. So I'm going to the members. I'm going to present to them my Article 13 claim because you said I had to pick one or the other. So now we're turning members into Article 13 specialists. And it's up to members to determine, one, whether there's an Article 13 violation, and two, what is the normative amount of award or credit one should get for that Article 13 violation. That strikes to me as a judge matter, not a members matter.
If it were to be presented during
pre-sentencing. Pretend that was a question.
Yes, if it were to be presented as pre-sentencing, the members would be deciding on an appropriate sentence. They would not be making those sort of determinations, and that would be the tactical decision that the defense counsel and the accused would have to make at that time. Present this evidence to a military judge who applied the law, or take my chances and present it to military members who are not bound by those requirements and will just do whatever they think gives an appropriate sentence.
Or both, under your criteria. They can try to do both.
No, I think that went away.
Did that go away?
Well, it sounds to me like we want us to overrule Inong insofar as it muddied the Southwick waters.
No, Your Honor. Inong dealt with waiver.
Yeah.
And that's what we're...
Well, isn't it cleaner to just say...
No, if you don't, if you don't waiver.
if you don't do it, it's waived.
Well, the Inong stands for the proposition. It has to be raised at some point at the trial level or it's waived. And that can still remain in place irrespective of when the evidence is presented.
All right. Perhaps happily or not, the time is up. Anything else you'd like to say?
The as gatekeeper, appellant exercised tactical decisions, and he has not shown prejudice in this case. He agreed to the specific amount of credit that he received. And absent any additional questions, the government would ask this court to affirm the finding and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, you have opportunity for a rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Can I ask you what you think the difference between you and the government is?
Yes, Your Honor. And I have 2 points, and my first point goes to that exact
question. Okay.
Gatekeeper, that term and that concept is not mentioned anywhere in Southwick. That is a Gammons concept based on the language in 15F. And the government would have this court reach back through Enam, through Southwick, into Gammons, and pull this gatekeeper concept that applies strictly to Article 15 and pull it into the Article 13 arena. And that is simply improper, because the government action is almost always, or will almost always be relevant for mitigation purposes when it concerns illegal pretrial punishment, or when it concerns something that maybe comes close but isn't quite illegal pretrial punishment. It may still be relevant. And that's where the judge should be allowed on a case-by-case basis to make the determination based on the facts. Article 13, an Article 13 motion and credit granted or not granted doesn't magically make these actions by the government irrelevant. They're either relevant or they're not, regardless of whether or not an Article 13 motion is made or whether the credit is given. My second point is, here's the rule. Here's how this works generally, and it has been working. Here's how it worked in Barnett, and here's how it should work going forward. An accused presents an Article 13 motion pre-trial or during trial, or they don't. Up to them and their defense counsel. The government can object, they can agree. If it's a guilty plea, they can stipulate perhaps how much credit is going to be given ahead of time and that it may or may not be used at sentencing, but that should be left to the defense counsel. The military judge then makes a ruling, which is a legal determination about how much credit should be given, this amorphous calculation. The defendant can then make a determination as to whether they want to proceed with introducing this evidence under 1001 or not. The government can object to that based on relevance grounds or based on 403 grounds, and the military judge, based on the facts of that case, will make a decision. And then if the evidence comes in, the military judge will give an appropriate instruction, again, tailored to the facts of the case, as he's required to do, to the panel to make sure that they give a fair sentence based on all of the facts that they've considered and without consideration of any clemency given or without consideration to credit, which is normally some of the standard language that comes in. And that's how this should be handled moving forward. That's the easiest, clearest way. If this court tries to draw a line in the sand, it's going to create a number of more problems. This court cannot anticipate how many different ways this can go. So the military judge should be allowed to do their job and make this determination. Any further questions?
No further question. The court thanks both counsel for the argument today. Case is submitted, and we stand in recess until further order of the court.
The court is adjourned until further order of the court.